We are in pretty good shape anyway. I only got 1 hour tonight. I don't hurt us that bad. Come to chapter 12. And chapter 12 is the first two verses are one of those verses that get preached on a lot. Actually, gets preached on a lot and memorized a lot. I beseech thee, urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service and worship. You shall be conformed to this world, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Now, but one of the dangers of knowing this verse so well is that you memorize it in church camp or vacation Bible school. But you undoubtedly memorize it in isolation of its context. I urge you therefore, but for therefore is always, you say there for something. And what is it there for? It's a continuation of the argument. And it, he is not talking about a sacrifice in general, he's talking about a particular kind of sacrifice. We'll see. Keep in mind the context. He's talking about the broken fellowship. Now, he has made it very clear that God has cast off national Israel. He has saved spiritual Israel, the only one he ever made a promise to. But that the temple-centered Judaism, Jewish national religion, as I call it, is no longer efficacious. That's not, he's provided, he's proved that it does not make the Jews better than the Gentiles. Well, in the light of that, that's what the therefore refers to. He referred back to what he said thus far. But the therefore, if I understand this text in particular, refers back to the fact that since Jewish national religion is no longer efficacious, and since salvation has always been by faith, on the basis of this, I urge you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, there are two aspects of this when we begin chapter 12. One is the aspect of the metaphor, you would call it. That is, since animal sacrifice is no longer counts, since the old covenant is dead, as the woman's husband we talked about, then the new covenant calls for a new kind of sacrifice. That is the significance of the language. A living sacrifice. I urge you therefore, since we have a new system, a new kind of sacrifice that God's going to accept, I urge you to offer this word. But one of the keys to remember, to thinking about this and understanding it is this ambiguous word. It's been ambiguous in translation. The old King James said, which is your reasonable service. The newer translations say spiritual service. It's very, I won't go into the Greek word, but it's a very specialized kind of word. What it means is, and really, the King James gave it one emphasis, and the newer translations give it another emphasis. A way I think it should be translated is this. I'll give you an amplified translation. Ready? That in the light of the fact that the old system of worship, focusing on temple worship and salvation by works as they conceived of it, although they were wrong, the old covenant, the law, since that is no longer counts, I urge you therefore to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your appropriate kind of service, or appropriately spiritual sacrifice, or appropriately spiritual service. But what he's getting at with the group, what he's getting at the language is that the old system called for one kind of sacrifice, but the new system calls for another kind of sacrifice. The old system calls for animal sacrifice. The new system calls for a living sacrifice. And since we're under the new covenant, a living sacrifice is It is spiritual as opposed to physical, a spiritual sacrifice as opposed to animal and physical sacrifice, and it is appropriate. And appropriately, or not appropriately, spiritual, that's not to say it exactly. It is, let me give you an amplified translation. A sacrifice which is a spiritual, in parentheses, as opposed to physical, and is therefore appropriate. Did y'all get that? That's a very, well, you can see how it fits in, can't you? You see, it's reasonable. Reasonable in the light of what? Well, it's unreasonable to depend on the old system for under the new system. It's like it was unreasonable for a woman to live under the rules of her old husband when he was dead, she was married to a new husband. That's not reasonable. And that's not appropriate, doesn't fit, doesn't make sense. And the new system and the new sacrifice is spiritual, opposed to physical, so it, understand? Both the translation reasonable got at it, but didn't really say it, and the translation spiritual got at it, but came a little bit short. Really, it's both. It's spiritual and therefore appropriate. Okay. Now, that's the significance of the language. It's quite powerful, isn't it? A new system, a new sacrifice. Spiritual and therefore appropriate, or reasonable. Now, sacrifice in what sense? What does it mean, spiritual sacrifice? Well, I'm going to kind of look ahead again, cheat a little bit. He's not talking about the Christian life in general. He's talking about the problem at Rome. He's talking about putting, as he words it later, putting others ahead of yourself. Now, keep in mind, he is not talking about the Christian life in general. He's talking about the situation. Remember I said Romans is a one sustained discussion. Now, you'll see when you get into it that I'm right. That's why, when you are, you are right if I'm a teacher, that makes you right. But other than that, you'll see that I have a reason for this. He's talking about the hardest kind of sacrifice of all, and that is the sacrifice itself. Present your body as a living sacrifice. Now, what does that mean? It means the sacrifice of self, which was really the only solution to the fellowship problem there in Rome. That is, that their problem was the elevation of self. The Jews were elevating themselves above the Gentiles, the Gentiles were elevating themselves above the Jews. Therefore, the new system calls for a different attitude, a spiritual sacrifice, and therefore reasonable. But he's focused upon the sacrifice of self in the sense of the Gentiles were going to have to come off their high and mighty and treat the Jews as better than themselves, as this is the Christian formula, and the Gentiles and the Jews can do the same thing for the Gentiles. Now that's the hardest kind of sacrifice of all. I recall that was reasonably similar that was during Gandhi's Pasti Revolution in India. He invoked the power of the British Empire in India. There was one of the leaders was a Muslim named Muhammad Ali, not the same name as the boxer, but not the same name. And he was one of the leaders, and he was giving a speech and found out what he was going to sacrifice for the cause, the revolution. And he said, I'm committed to this. Everybody cheered. He said, I'm committed all the way on this. Everybody cheered. He said, it's necessary that I sacrifice everything I own. Everybody cheered. He said, if necessary, I'd sacrifice my family. Everybody cheered. He said, like he said, and then he came right down to it, I didn't give up my own life. But after the house and the kids, that's the women and children. I go last. I give up my wife and my kids. If it really got down to it, I'd give up me, but only if necessary. Well, I thought, when I read that, I thought, that's it. That's the way, that's just about the spirit that we go into, the spirit of sacrifice that we go into the kingdom. You know, I'll give up anything but me. I'll give up comfort, I'll give up money. But we don't give up us for a reason. And it's very, very, and we are all guilty of this. This is very pointed toward us. Why is it? I've seen missionaries
make great sacrifices when they reach the field. Sacrifice the health of their family, and make financial sacrifices, and work hard, and they go and work some matters. In 18 months, they're back home. Why? And we couldn't get along with the other missionaries. What happened? Well, he gave up everything, like Muhammad Ali, except himself. The touchy self. And we're like that. I'm like that. You know why? Our pride gets in the way. And, you know, we don't mind being a servant as long as nobody treats us like one. We're going to serve the Lord until somebody suggests that we're going to be treated like a servant. Then we get very huffy and arrogant and get our feelings hurt. And he said, somebody's going to treat me like that. And he do something. But pride. You really put others above. You see, this is a really sacrifice. It's the hardest sacrifice of all. The sacrifice of self. For instance, Lewis Foster said something one time that I always remember. He said, we had no idea how much work could be done for the kingdom if it didn't make any difference. You got the credit. If you're in the local ministry very long, you'll know. You'll learn this. That one of the things you have to be so careful to do is thank everybody for everything. And then you take your life in your hands, because if you forget somebody, if you forget that Edna, you know, baked the beans, you know, or Uncle Charlie stepped off the front wall, you thank somebody else, you don't thank them. Boy, your life is forfeit. Why is that? Why do we have to be so careful? I'm not saying we ought not to express that as a Christian virtue to thank people. But boy, anymore, you don't do it. Why? You leave somebody, can't leave anybody out. Why? Because of self. I want to make sure I get what's coming to me. I want to make sure that I'm treated right. Well, this was the problem in Rome. I came out. The sacrifice, the body, your body's a living sacrifice. He's not talking about Christian service in general. He's talking about this attitude that the Jews and the Gentiles both had, where they elevated themselves. And do not be conformed again.
He said the three things that you were kind of on parallel, it was like the body as opposed to the temple and the living sacrifices
for the
animals.
I'm saying there's two elements. There's the language I was talking about. The appropriate for the language, the sacrifice fitting into the covenant. In these scriptures. But I'm simply saying that when he talks about your body living sacrifice, he's talking about in a very pointed way about this attitude that was about in the church. Well, we'll see this as we go. We want to go very far. Do not be conformed to this world. Now, this he's repeating himself. Remember my discussion in Romans 8 of if you're going to be a son, you have to have the heart of the Father. To be otherwise is to be led by what he called the flesh. Spirit versus flesh. Now, again, when he said, do not be conformed to this world, he is not talking about. Now, don't misunderstand me. On this principle of the sacrifice, we can legitimately apply it to the Christian life in general, as long as we understand that he is not doing it here. The principle can be generalized. But he is speaking of something very specific here. And when he says, do not be conformed to the world, again, the principle can be generalized. In general, we ought not to be conformed to the world. But in particular, Paul is saying that what the attitude in the Roman church, which was dividing the church, was just like the world. They had not, they were no different than what's how the world acts. Being conformed, so he's saying, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Don't be conformed to the world in this particular thing. You see, the world is jealous and self-serving and egoistic and egocentric. Ought not to be that way in the church. Do not be like the world in this particular thing, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may prove, really, a better translation would be demonstrate. Show the worthiness of, perhaps, and demonstrate is kind of a weak word, weak translation.
that you may actualize, have realized in your life, live out. You see that? That you may be an example of what is what the will of God is, which is good and acceptable and mature, perfect. I would prefer mature here. For, we continue the discussion. For, through the grace given to me, I'm talking about his apostleship. He uses that, even now, he uses that phrase. When Paul uses that phrase, through the grace given to me, he's talking about the gift of being an apostle to the Gentiles. He's claiming his authority. By the authority of my apostleship, I say to you. Now, you don't get it, you wouldn't know that from this, because this is the only time that appeared. But I'm saying if you take that phrase and see how he uses that consistently with all his writings, that's what it means. By the basis of my apostleship, I say to every man among you, got this, for, do all this, for, by my authority, I say to you, to every man among you, there's that word again, every one of you, both sides of the aisle, Jews and Gentiles, to do what? Not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allowed to each a measure of faith. There it is. That's the living sacrifice. It is a genuine sacrifice. The death. Before we will not think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think, a genuine death has to take place. The death of self. It's the hardest death of all. And you see what I said? My point that he was talking about one particular kind of thing, but that's part of the same sentence almost. I do not think more highly than you ought to think. This is the sacrifice. This is the sacrifice of making the body a living sacrifice. But to think so as to have sound, I like it. But to think so as to have sound judgment. But to think so as to have sound judgment. what he was saying was, if you think otherwise, it's stupid. It's silly. It's not it's not realistic, because as a matter of fact, I mean, you already think about it. Most of the time, we're up on our high and mighty. We really shouldn't be there. I mean, any man doesn't know. I like this statement. This is sort of that's what he said. If you read over, a man not to think more high than he ought to think, but in contrast to think so as to have sound judgment. I don't trust a man that doesn't have sense of humor. I don't need to go tell jokes. Some people can tell jokes, some can't. Some people can read the phone book to make you laugh. Others can tell you the best joke you ever heard in your life and you just die. Right, died of a horrible day. I got a friend in the ministry, Bud Down, Larry Down, good preacher, a little church over there in Ohio, in the suburb of Cincinnati, and stayed with it over the years, done excellent work. Had a revival for him one time, and we just got, and Bud just simply cannot tell jokes. He just can't do it. And I was up there just preaching normally. And then the people were in the aisles, just flapping their knees. I didn't really watch the that hadn't heard anything funny in the church for so long, just about tore him up. But he had a sense of humor, he just couldn't tell a joke. Back to my point, I don't trust a man. If I find somebody that doesn't have a sense of humor, I usually keep as much distance between them and me as possible. Why? Most of the time, when a person doesn't have a sense of humor, it's because they take themselves with deadly gravity. That's usually why a person doesn't have a sense of humor. They take themselves so seriously. And anybody that takes himself so seriously, eventually they'll get you. It's like carrying a man or a woman who takes themselves with deadly sobriety. If I'm like somebody walking around with a loaded shotgun, it's going to go off eventually. You'll probably be in the way. They'll get you. They'll cut you down. And I'm going to say this, if we haven't learned enough, y'all been to school long enough, we said, if we don't know how ridiculous we are most of the time, how inconsistent we are. We think we're consistent, everybody else is just, out of bounds, but we're consistent. If we don't know that we are ridiculous, but every hour on the hour.
Amen.
If we don't know that we really are ignorant, especially you.
I don't think that's funny.
If we don't know, if we're not smart enough to know just how much other people have to forgive us on a regular basis for us to get through this life, if we don't know some of those things, we do not have sound judgment. Arrogance is stupidity for the simple reason that it's not reasonable, it's not a reasonable service, and that we simply do not know, if we do not know how stupid we are about most things, then we simply do not have sound judgment. And if you've never learned the art of laughing at yourself, then I suggest you learn it. If you laugh at yourself, people will laugh with you. You can be close to people. If you don't laugh at yourself, people will laugh at you behind your back. We all get laughed at, and we all deserve it.
I'm very serious about this.
But a man not think more high of himself than he ought to think. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It's another context. You called me out in the ministry. If you don't know, especially young going in, if you don't know that the church has just as much to teach you about Christianity as you have to teach the church, if you don't know that, learn it. It's the truth. It's the absolute truth. The fact that you've been to Bible college does not mean that you know all about Christianity. And the smartest preachers I know are those who've learned from their people. You'll learn much, but not if you think you already know it. You understand? It is not sound judgment to think otherwise. And we're all ignorant. We're just ignorant about different things. You see, what happens with preachers, and I know, you see, preachers spend most of the time on their own turf. When you're on your own turf, you're the big shot. You know it all. You're the expert when you're on your own turf. A lot of times it's misleading. A lot of times preachers, the only time they really are with their people is at church. Well, that's the preacher's turf. In a Bible school class, and then they're the professional, they're the expert. And they come across as the super intelligent leader. But you work with some of the people in the church on their turf sometimes and see how smart you look. It's kind of artificial, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of times preachers don't realize that. They always come off sound and smart because they know more about the Bible than anybody in the church does, because they've been to college, Bible college, usually. But that, you see, they just don't touch the church. You don't get around to the areas where you're ignorant of. Everybody's ignorant. We're just ignorant of different things. Isn't that true? So the point I'm trying to make is that when we say, it is truly, it's an attitude, because of our natural arrogance, because of what sin does to us, it is a sacrifice for us to think, to stop thinking more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. But it is not a martyrdom in the sense that we really are, you see, better than other people. But we're going to be magnanimous about it and act like we're not. I mean, really, I am a super person, but part of my being super is I'm super humble. I can now humble you any day of the week. I mean, all of us are very proud of my ego. So even though I'm really, kind of halfway between Moses and St. Francis of Assisi and Superman, I am going to be big about it, and I'm going to condescend to you. That is not what he's teaching. He said it's not sound judgment. Why? That's because it's not that way at all.
People realize it.
Well, sure they do. You might as well admit it, because they know it.
They're laughing at you.
That's right. Isn't that true? I know some preachers, if the congregation ever laughed at them, they would absolutely go out and smoke. I mean, they would just fade away, just die. Why? You're my sanctimonious seclusion up here in my ivory tower.
It's like nothing in God.
That's right. It's worse, really. A
phrase exactly right. People know this. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to be stoic, but it does mean that we need to come down. We need to do what Paul is telling the Roman Christians to do is that we need to be very much aware that is the realistic view of life, not to take this attitude. Okay, howdy. Okay, any questions on verses 1-3? You see the point? Well, that's right. Isn't that text much more rich than you thought it was? You know, it's one you probably have memorized. It's a very exciting text. Now, but the discussion continues. For now, you talk about the fact that we ought to not think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. Just as we have many, and here he uses the same language used in 1 Corinthians 12, the metaphor of the body, which we all know very well. Yes.
So I can catch all of it, but in the last part of that, as God has allowed it to use another faith.
That, yeah, that's a, it's pretty good bringing that up. as God has allowed it to each a measure of faith. Here, faith is used in the sense that, in the sense of, and we see from the context, in the sense of, it's roughly a synonym for, it's the same thing as saying God has allowed each a share in the faith, or a share in the kingdom. Faith, you go back to Romans, talk about faith versus law. Faith versus, it's idiomatic. He's not saying that God has decided, I'm going to give you 10 pounds of faith, and then the three some 9 pounds, later 12, you call it. Not what he's saying. He's saying, it's an idiomatic use of the word faith, as it often is, to mean each has a different, and he's speaking the context, each has a different level of ministry in the faith, in the kingdom.
Just like what you were saying about each of us is stupid about everything.
Right, and we see it in the body itself. We're all familiar with this. This is, we have many members in one body, different parts of the body. So, and all the members don't have the same function. So, we who are many are one body, and in Christ, and individually members one of another. Now, he expands his discussion in 1 Corinthians 12, where he said, one cannot say I'm better than the other. Most of the Corinthian Christians have the same problem. Okay, and I think we're familiar enough with this. I don't have to talk about it very much. Since that we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, or the gift given to us, let each exercise them accordingly. If prophecy, according to the proportion of his faith. If service, now in prophecy, that is in the sense of that which he has been given. In service, in his serving. By the way, you notice that unless this is the miraculous gift of prophecy, which it might or might not be, because prophecy is used both ways, there are no miraculous gifts in here. You want three. List of gifts. It's a later list. Later list. It's easy for you to say. He who teaches in his teaching. That is, tend to business. He who exhorts in his exhortation. He who gives with liberality. He who leads with diligence. Probably talking about the elders there. He who shows mercy with cheerfulness. Probably those who are in charge of the benevolent work of the church. Showing mercy. So he's saying, you do what you can do. Get down to business, tend to your business, and don't be lording over the other, the opposite party in the church. Love be without hypocrisy. Now this is a hearkening back to this Romans 8 discussion again. We really have the spirit of the Father. Real love, the real thing. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. And you can see he's focusing in on, he's not simply saying we all have gifts. And if you have your gift of teaching, make sure you do it well. He's saying not only that, but he's also saying in context that you do this as opposed to worrying about whether you're going to be more important than your brother. I'm a great believer in the local ministry of the preacher doing his job and not doing anybody else's job. I know it. When I was at Westside for so long, I didn't belong to any committee except the worship committee, because I was in charge of the worship service. And I wasn't the chairman of that. I didn't go to the elders' meeting unless they asked me. I trained them, but they had their job and I had my job. And unfortunately, the preacher's father, he told his preacher that he said, oh no, I'm the ex officio member of every committee. I've got to keep my hand on what's going on in the church. I mean, the ladies had a meeting. He showed up. You know, there was a subcommittee on how much toilet paper to buy next month. You had to be there and had to get his say in. The people got sick of it. So finally, everybody said, well, the real leaders of the church said, well, since you want to run everything, I'll go do something else, and you run it. And he ended up, and the whole thing ended up falling apart because he insisted on doing his job and making sure that he saw that everybody else was. And he made a very turn to you. He didn't trust him. It's a very stupid thing to do. You don't know anything about buildings, stay off the building committee. You probably got men in the church who know how to do it. Keep out of their cotton picking away. I'm very serious about that. The elders got their job, stay out of their way. Don't use them as a rubber stamp. Let them develop their program, encourage them and help them, but let them do it. Don't second guess them, and don't clean up after them, and don't humiliate them. Let them do it. They're probably better at it than you are. I learned much. Most of what I know about the elders is I learned from elders who showed me who demonstrated it. You know, I do my job, you do yours. But now the point, the fact that my job puts me up in front of you regularly doesn't mean I'm better than you are. That's the point of this metaphor of the body. The fact that some, it expanded in 1 Corinthians 12, some parts of the body, he says, we count as more honorable, others as less honorable, but everything is important. And listen to me, what goes on in the pulpit is not more precious in the eyes of God than what goes on in the nursery. It may be more central, but it's not more important. In the sense that it is not, what I'm saying is this, but my point is, it is just as important to clean the church building well as it is to preach well. And I think, I'm of the opinion that you make a view. There are two views of ministry today. One view is that the minister is supposed to be good at everything. Now that's stupid. That's ridiculous. Nobody is that good. But I'm teaching you fellows that your job, you go to ministry, that is you need to limit yourself to prayer and the word and evangelism. But the focus of the whole thing is teaching. That's your job. That's your thing to do. That's about the other stuff. One of the reasons that there's not more teaching going on in our church is that everybody has the idea, including the preacher, that he's supposed to do a thousand different things all week. Quit counseling and starting studying and preaching. Waste your time counseling for the most part. If they don't do it when you tell them from the pulpit, they're not going to do it when you tell them in the office. Take my word for it. I'm not saying don't counsel any. I'm saying do one-tenth of the counseling that you make more preachers make. The nine-tenths of the counseling that you do is totally wasting time. The one thing is free, and people don't take advice and they don't pay for it. They charge them $100 a session, they probably do it. Secondly, everybody already knows what the problem is. They have no intention of doing what God wants done, but they want you to tell them it's okay. Nine times out of ten, this has been my experience of every preacher I know. Your job is not to be a psychologist. Your job is to be a preacher. Anyway, that's my sermon on that subject. So do your job, he says. If you're teaching, do it. And stick to your business and quit lording it over everybody else. Wouldn't the church be great if everybody just did their job and kept their mouth shut? Then try to learn everybody else's lie? No. Think how much energy in the local, take our Bible colleges. Let's take an example of our Bible, our student Bible. Think how much everybody's grades would go up. Think how much more, how better our service would be if we just could use the energy we're wasting keeping the ruling mill going. Just how much energy, wouldn't the student body be better off if everybody just did their job, tended their business, and kept their mouth shut about everybody else?
That's true everywhere.
It's true in life, true in the church. Well, it was tearing the Church of Rome apart. Look at this. Now look at this. He says, be devoted to one another. Let love be without hypocrisy. Verse 10. Be devoted to one another. There it is again in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. There it is. There's that sacrifice again. Give. That's the living. That's the sacrifice of the body. The spiritual service. The reasonable service. Give preference to one another in honor. What does that mean? Well, James talks about this. Of course, he uses, it's kind of funny. James uses hyperbole. You know, the rich man comes into the service and he says, oh, here we got two people right here at the front. And he writes, the guy rides in, the guy drives up in the Mercedes, you know, wearing the big ring. And we pick him up, we put him in the floor seat in the house, and some guy comes in the church bus. And we said, here, sit under my school name board. Good to see you here. You sit in the pew, believe nobody can see you. But it was humorous. But so that attitude is not to be. God is no respecter of persons. Give preference to one another. So, in context, he's saying to the Jews, you've been saying, oh, well, we are much better than the Gentiles. He says, say this. Well, they are much better than us. We have much to learn from them. Did you say that? I'm speaking Gentiles. And so he says to the Jews, now you say that the Gentiles, you say about the Jews that they are an honored people. And they're our brothers. And we respect them. And they deserve more honor than we do. Well, Christ tells us, thinking Jews, I mean, you know, everybody knows their faces. Am I supposed to say that?
No,
babe. Now that would be very hard for a Jew. Can you imagine? Now you can only think about how it works. Here's a Jew. He looks at his neighbor across the, you know, across the table in the agape, the love feast in the church. Look at a guy who's sitting there eating pork chops with unwashed hands. He's a Sabbath breaker, uncircumcised Gentile. I'm supposed to say it. All my life I've been trained that he's one notch above an animal. And I'm supposed to say to him, brother, I want you to know, God, that you're to be honored above me. You're a better man than I am. Are you sure about that, Paul? That would be like a white a white Southerner saying about, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, saying about a sharecropper, you're worthy of more honor than I am. You can see, can't you? It is a real sacrifice. It is a putting to death. And it is for us. We're like that. Okay. Let's go over to the top. Not lagging. Let's go on down through verse 15. Not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Now here, this is what Paul often does. He gets started and can't get stopped. The series is more or less general admonition. Rejoicing in hope. Talk about all these. Persevering in tribulation. Devoted to prayer. That's a good one to talk about for a while. Contributing to the needs of the saints. Practicing hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with those who rejoice. This is beautiful. This one is a beautiful verse. Weep with those who weep. Now he's back to it again. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do nothing. Never gets very far from the theme. You see that in this chapter? Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. It says three times. Verse 3, every man of you, I said every man of you, not think more high of himself than he ought to think. Verse 10, give preference to one another. Verse 16, be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind. Do not be wise in your own estimation. There it is again. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Why? That's weird. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. You can't talk about the church there in Rome. Be at peace with each other.
If possible. Yeah.
And all men do. If possible, as far as much as you can.
How does that
if
possible refer to all of it? Is that one?
Just that one statement. If possible, The part that depends on you, be a piece of all men. And that's impossible. Always not a piece of all men. But it's possible. Now, you understand that Paul talks about, you go through the life of Paul. But Jesus is a piece of all men. There was, Paul was, nobody, the church never will be a piece of all men. But as much as possible. We'll fight more than half to. And make sure you fight about the right thing. Augustine spends his time, I'll just leave it, it's pretty much self-explanatory. And again, he's talking about this attitude that we're going to be mutual acceptance. Never pay back evil, or evil people, I'm sorry. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. That's here, don't steal from God. If you take vengeance, you're stealing from God. But why? Vengeance is just his mind, says the Lord. I will repay. But if your enemy is hungry, and quoting the Old Testament, which is like in Proverbs, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head. And that's a whole problem. That's very tough. What it means, heaping coals upon his head. There's many interpretations of that. Coals of judgment or coals of repentance. A shame. It's a tough. There are many options on that. Do not be overcome by evil. Be overcome evil. What a general teaching on the importance of accepting one another. Kind of a conclusion. Now, chapter, there's more to go, but chapter 12 is pretty much a summary and conclusion chapter of the first, in other words, of the first 12 chapters. Now, it's not complete. It goes on. But it's really, chapter 12 is a tying together thing. Saying, okay, I said all this, now he's really hammering on this theme of accepting one another and humility. Okay, we'll be dismissed.